Today is Friday, October 4th, Larry. And so nice to have you back.
Thank you. I am here.
Yeah. Let's get started, Larry, with the latest information on the Iranian attack on Israel. And here is the new information coming out of the satellites that they're showing that more than 32 missiles have hit the Nevatim airbase. And what do we know about these information?
Well, it's subject to a lot of spin. Israel's insisting, you know, like that iconic scene that I always like to use on my blog from the movie Naked Gun with Leslie Nielsen, where the building's on fire, bombs are bursting, cars are crashing, people are running around screaming, and Nielsen saying, "Nothing to see here, move along, nothing to see here." So that's Israel. They claimed, "Oh, we shot down all the missiles, most of the missiles, and the ones that did come down, they didn't hit anything." Well, that's just a flat-out lie. Iran, for its part, said, "Oh, yeah, we destroyed 20 F-35s. Well, that's a lie. That didn't happen. This was, you know, there are a couple of ways that people like to look at this. So let's deal with the fact. The fact is, according to the videos that I've seen, the vast majority of the missiles fired by Iran hit the ground. They did not get intercepted in the air, whether it was by Aerosling or Iron Dome or whatever. The Israeli air defense system was completely penetrated. Now, what kind of missiles were fired? I don't know. There are some that are described as hypersonic, which means they're traveling faster than, five times faster than the speed of sound. So that's what we know for sure. What was hit? So there was not a lot of visible physical damage, but what damage there is, Israel is covering it up. They're hiding it. They've imposed a media blackout. It would seem to me that, you know, if you shot at me and didn't hit me, I'd be happy to show, say, "You didn't hit me. No holes, no blood." So I interpret that as the fact that there were, you know, Iran did end up hitting some targets. And Israel doesn't even want to admit to that because it both exposes their lies and is an acknowledgement that they can, that Iran can penetrate Israel's air defense. Now, the assumption on the Israeli side is that Iran was trying to hit special targets and missed. Well, we know that Iran, similar to what happened in April, when it launched the first missile attack on Israel in response to the bombing of its consulate, its embassy facility in Damascus, that in April, Iran warned everybody what it was going to do. It didn't want there to be any confusion, any doubt. "Hey, we're going to hit you." And so the West and Israel were well prepared, so that they shot down drones, shot down cruise missiles, tried and failed to shoot down some of the ballistic missiles. then this go round, once again, Iran let Washington and Moscow know about at least 2 hours in advance what it was going to do. And why is that important? Well, because you tell Washington, they're going to tell Israel, "Hey, get ready, here they come." And so if you're the Israelis, what do? Well, number one, you take your aircraft that might be potentially targets and you put them in the air so they can't be hit. You put personnel in secure bunkers so they can't be killed. And here's the other fact that we know from this attack. So far, that attack only killed one person. some poor Palestinian guy who was stepping off the curb to walk across the street, and one of the stages off of one of these rockets actually fell down and just crushed him. That was it. So clearly, Iran was taking steps to avoid civilian casualties, but they were also sending a clear message. They told the United States and Moscow, we're going to hit military and intelligence targets, which is exactly what they did. And yet, as you could see in that photo that you posted, the shots were scattered all over. They weren't concentrated. I believe what Iran was doing in this case was it was escalating from what it did in April. In April, it was simply trying to show Israel and the United States and the rest of the world, hey, we can attack Israel if we want, and they can't stop us. And unfortunately, the lesson the West took from that attack in April is they said, it was an utter big failure, complete failure for Iran. So they didn't step back and say, okay, yeah, we do have a problem. Iran does have the capability to launch missiles that can hit inside Israel. So this time, they sent a clear message. They targeted Mossad headquarters. They targeted two air bases, and they targeted a natural gas platform. They hit the gas platform. They also hit at least Nevatim air base in the Negev. And the other one, I don't recall the name of it, but it was hit as well. But they didn't cause extensive damage. And this was it, but this was with missiles. And now Iran's message is, look, we told you before, now we're showing you what we can do, but we still warned you. We still gave you advanced warning. And that's because I believe Iran's not interested in escalating this conflict into a full-blown war, while Israel is. But Iran was sending Israel a message saying, look, you want to escalate this up, okay, we can do that, only next time there's not going to be any warning. And that's what the Iranian officials came out after the missile launch and said, okay, we're done. We've accomplished our mission. We've retaliated achieved our vengeance for your murder of Hassan Nasrallah and Haniyeh, Ismail Haniyeh. But Israel, if you attack us again, if you come here, then the next one is going to be more destructive, more deadly. I take him at their word. I don't think the Iranians are bluffing. And that's part of the problem in the West. The West was consistently saying, the Iranians, they're bluffing. They're just full of hot air. No, they're not. They're not Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey. The Iranians mean business. So this is, Israel's initial reaction, very emotional. Oh, we're gonna get you. All right, we're still waiting. I believe one of the reasons they're waiting is because there's pressure from the United States not to do this. Pressure from Moscow not to do it. Pressure from other countries not to do it because they recognize the escalation. China. Last thing China wants is a war. You start tossing missiles back and forth between Iran and Israel, oil in the Persian Gulf would get shut down, and that hurts China. So it's a very, we're sitting on the knife's edge right now.
Yeah, we've learned that Israel dropped 73 tons of explosives on a Hezbollah intelligence headquarters in Beirut in order to kill Nasrallah's successor. And the guy who's going to replace Nasrallah, so far we haven't heard from him, Larry. And what do we know about him? And what has he, did the Israelis try to kill him?
Well, I think one reason They're not, Hezbollah's not putting anybody out front right now. Is they recognize that there's no value in talking to the West. Now, it looks like Nasrallah was killed because he believed in the promises of Washington and Paris about a ceasefire. In fact, the West knew where he was, not because they had great intelligence, not because they had a mole inside. They had negotiated with him, and he had agreed to have a ceasefire on the part of Hezbollah in exchange to achieve a ceasefire for the Palestinians. And the Israelis were part of that negotiation. And they knew he was meeting with a top general in the Iranian Revolutionary Guard to talk about the ceasefire and what that would mean. And he brought in other senior members of Hezbollah to deal with that. This was a trap. The West set a trap, or at least the West inadvertently helped set the trap, and Israel sprung it. I mean, really, it's one of the most cowardly war crimes, in my view, because, you know, here you had somebody who was genuinely trying to negotiate an end to the killing. And that's all Israel wants to do is kill. And they don't care who they kill. They continue to murder women and children primarily. This meeting was a setup. And Nasrallah paid for it with his life. So, you know, the Israelis naively assume that just if they kill enough senior Hezbollah leadership, that they're going to go away. They'll go, oh, stop. We can't stand the pain anymore. Oh, we give up. That's not them. They are people of deep faith. Now, people in the, you know, Christians and Jews may not appreciate the depth of their faith. They may try to dismiss it, but, you know, I understand what it means when somebody has deep convictions about something that's spiritual, that they conceive of as spiritual. So this is, Israel's making a very, very grave mistake in pursuing the policy of assassination and killing, because it done it for 50 years, and that hasn't stopped the violence at all. It's actually what they're doing right now, I believe, is their overreaction, their extreme responses by Israel's extreme actions and responses is creating a literal tidal wave of hatred and resentment towards not just Israel, but Jews in general. And it's, you know, that's going to be a very terrible backlash. There was a point where the Israelis pushed this mythology of David versus Goliath. They were the David. The Arab Muslim nations were the Goliath. And they were going to, they had to stand up all on their own against this. Where, you know, the reality is that the Israelis, by displacing local populations and stealing land from them and failing to then negotiate in good faith, have created a resentment now that countries, even in Jordan and Turkey, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, which of late it was, you know, seriously considering a peace agreement with Israel, are walking away from that now. Just yesterday, I believe it was, the Saudi foreign minister was meeting with his Iranian counterpart, and talking about the need for improved relations between the two, and that they both agreed on a two-state, that there needed to be a Palestinian state, absolutely. Well, that wasn't the position of Saudi Arabia 2 years ago. And sure as hell wasn't the position of Saudi Arabia 6 years ago, when they were essentially fighting a proxy war with Iran using Yemen. And we're fully in the camp of the United States. So this, like I said, the international order, the sort of the tradition, Israel is so busy alienating other countries that it's just leaving the United States and Israel isolated.
What you've suggested about Nasrallah and he's agreeing, he has agreed on having some sort of ceasefire. And here is was confirmed by Lebanese foreign minister in his recent interview with Christiane Amanpour. I'm going to play it for the audience.
On fire on Israel, I spoke with Lebanon's foreign minister, Abdullah Bou Habib, who's in Washington to meet with American officials, and he joined us for his first interview since the latest escalations. Foreign Minister, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Thank you.
Things have reached a major crisis in your country since we last spoke. And I want to ask you, you are in the United States right now. You know that several of the administration officials agree with Israel's, you know, ground incursion into your country. What do you make of that as you're in Washington trying to get support for a ceasefire?
Well, they also agreed on the Biden-Macron statement that calls for a ceasefire, and that calls also the implementation for 21-day ceasefire, and then Mr. Hochstein would go to Lebanon and negotiate a ceasefire. Okay? And they told us that Mr. Netanyahu agreed on this. Mm-hmm. And so we also got the agreement of Hezbollah on that. And you know what happened since then. That was the day we saw you in New York.
I know, and you were talking about going into the Security Council for this ceasefire, and barely 24 hours later, the head of Hezbollah was assassinated. Are you saying Hassan Nasrallah had agreed to a ceasefire just moments before he was assassinated?
He agreed, yes. We agreed completely, Lebanon agreed to a ceasefire, but consulting with Hezbollah, the speaker, Mr. Birri, consulted with Hezbollah, and we informed the Americans and the French that what happened.
So,
and they told us that Mr. Netanyahu also agreed on the statement that was issued by both presidents.
Okay, well, as you know,
it's just confirming what you've just said.
Yeah, so it was a trap, and a very beyond cynical. It was evil. Because Nasrallah was genuinely trying to find a peaceful way out, and at the end of the attacks, Israel, the crazed Zionist zealots that are currently in control of Israel. Netanyahu's he's not really part of that zealotry per se. I mean, he's a political chameleon. He's all about power and himself. But the Smotrich and the Ben Gavirs, these guys are, they're seriously crazy. They're really trying to create conditions to usher in the appearance of the Messiah. And the only way the Messiah appears is if Israel is in danger of being destroyed. So that's what, that's what they're trying to set up. And all they know is killing. That, Israel likes to claim, oh, it's an existential threat to us. Look at how many of us have died at the hands of these vicious Palestinians. So I finally did look at the numbers. We've talked about this before. And between 2000 and 2014, Israel was killing 8 Palestinians for every 1 Israeli that died. Okay? An 8-to-1 disproportionate ratio. Since October 7th, that number has grown 20 times. Israel's killing 20 to 25 times more We're talking the deaths, total deaths now would be approaching 50,000, both Palestinians and Lebanese civilians. The vast majority of these are, you know, I'm sure there were some military personnel in those numbers, but they're not the majority. The vast majority are civilians. Israel has killed more civilians in the past year than Hamas and Hezbollah combined have killed of Israeli civilians in their entire existence by a vast number. So it's not even eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. It's like, we're going to take 10 eyes from you. You may get one of ours, but we're going to take 10 from you. This is the only way really to look at this current Israeli government is they're murderers, pure and simple. And they are like a serial killer. They have to be stopped, but there are two ways to stop them short of war. One is that the United States cuts off funding and arms. The United States isn't going to do that. Politically, the American people have been brainwashed into the lie that Iran's the greatest state sponsor of terrorism in the world. It's not. There's the evidence simply doesn't back that up. But that's the narrative. That's the story. With the story we tell ourselves so we can justify what we're doing. The second way to help bring an end to this lies in the hands of Turkey. So yeah, Erdogan, he like I said, I just continue to refer to him as a big bag of hot air. He talks tough. Oh yeah, we're going to do this. But they don't do it. What they allow the oil to flow. The oil, according to Pepe Escobar, that oil flows out of Azerbaijan through Turkey. All Turkey has to do is turn off the spigot, cut them off, stop. Then Israel's ability to continue to sustain operations will be called, they'll be hurt. And their economy is already suffering. Short of those two methods, which I've used sort of a peaceful approach, the next one will be, it'll be military, and it'll probably be Iran and the Houthis who deliver sort of the decisive blows. If Israel retaliates against Iran, as many anticipate, then Iran, I think, is they're going to take the gloves off, and I'm waiting to see what Ayatollah Khamenei says today. He's supposed to give a speech. Once that speech is given, then. And maybe he's already given it, but I haven't heard anything about it yet.
Yeah, he said that what we did was the minimum punishment for the Zionists, and we will respond harshly to any aggression. And the other thing, we must not rush any situation, must carefully study before reacting. This the second. And he's trying to bring everybody together. He's talking about that the main goal is just not let the Israelis reaching their goal in just exterminating Gazans, Palestinians.
Yeah.
These are the main points that he has made during this talk, during this speech that he made. And Larry, the new leaked documents show that Blinken lied to the Congress about Israelis' violation because the way that Israelis are using the weapons in Gaza and against Palestinians in order to let this flow of weapons not being interrupted. And how, in your opinion, how do you see the policy of Antony Blinken department, the policy that they have been implementing in Israel and Gaza?
I guess it's self-defeating policy. Blinken has really, I understand that he came out of the U.S. Congress as a staffer. He's a political hack. He had no experience with diplomacy, no real genuine experience with international affairs. He's very much focused on sort of the transactional, immediate deal in front of him. And he's turned the State Department into a disgrace. Not that it was great shakes before, but you've had several Foreign Service officers resign in protest over the U.S. policy towards Gaza. Looking back over the last almost 40 years, the meme, the narrative pushed in the United States is that the Palestinians have been given every opportunity to have peace, and they've rejected it every time because they just wanted to kill the Jews. And Israel, Israel, long-suffering Israel, has been striving for peace, but have been rebuffed at every turn. So now they've got to fight. That's all bullshit. It's a lie. From the beginning, Israel had zero intention of actually negotiating a settlement that would have allowed the Palestinians to actually have a free, independent country. The Zionists have always wanted full control of Gaza, full control of the West Bank. Hell, they'll want control of Jordan if they can get it, and all the way up to Beirut if they can get it. Because in their mind, it's Exodus, baby. God gave this land to me. This land is mine. That's their view. So they've sabotaged every possible peace agreement, and they're going up to and including funding Hamas. You know, the pumping millions of dollars into Hamas. Why? Because they saw as long as they could have Hamas, it was seen as a foil, as an opposition to the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, and Fatah. You also had a Palestinian organization that the United States funded as well. So, you know, this is all a charade, a complete charade. And now I think the Palestinian people with Hamas in the lead have finally said enough. Well, you know, we're gonna fight. We're gonna fight for our freedom.
Larry, here is Matt Miller talking about the policy of the United States in Israel and Palestine.
The second question is, the secretary and you often say that Israel has the right to defend itself, but how it does it, it matters. So this morning, there were 6 first responders were killed in Lebanon, civilians. In Gaza, it's over 40,000, 70% are women and children. In Lebanon, is 1 million people are homeless. So when he says how it matters, if there's no consequences in Israel, doesn't his word carry no weight? Does it mean that is really a statement for public consumption?
No, absolutely not.
Why?
Absolutely not. Look, wars have horrific consequences. They always have. They always will. And these wars have had horrific consequences for the people of Gaza and now for the people of Lebanon. It is why the U.S. has worked so hard to try to reach a diplomatic resolution to the conflict in Lebanon. And what you saw going back months is Hezbollah refusing to stop its attacks on civilian targets inside Israel. It's why we've tried to reach a ceasefire agreement in Gaza that would ultimately lead to the guns being silenced, hostages coming home, humanitarian assistance surging in. We will continue to pursue both of those things. But in each of these cases, it is just a little more complicated than the question concedes. It is more complicated when you have terrorist groups that hide inside civilians. When you look at the death of Hassan Nasrallah last week, where was he? Was he on a military compound? Was he on a compound that Hezbollah built where there were only members of Hezbollah? No, he was underneath a civilian apartment building. And when you look at what has happened over and over again in Gaza, you've seen Hamas.
So we'll kill all civilians. Yeah, we just.
The headquarters of Mossad is located. Where does it located?
Yeah, it's located in a civilian neighborhood. I mean, you know, Miller is one of the most despicable human beings, let's call him emblematic of the sickness and the corruption of the Biden administration. And I guarantee you that the Republicans were there right now, they wouldn't be any better. You know, this is it's ultimate. They keep the terrorism excuse is just it's a lie that we portrayed Hamas and Hezbollah as these great terrorist organizations, yet the actual numbers that are reported by the Israeli Foreign Ministry don't back that up. And you know, even the U.S. State Department's Bureau of Counterterrorism can't list the attacks of Hamas and Hezbollah because there have hardly been any. And in fact, Hezbollah, when you go back and look at it, has been largely, they've made a point about targeting military and government sites, not civilian sites. They've had some attacks on civilians in the past, but that was in the 80s. You know, they moved past that. Particularly over the last 10, 12 years, it's been going after military targets. That's what they do. Israel, by contrast, gleefully kills civilians, targeting hospitals, aid workers, reporters, you name it, they kill it.
Yeah. Israel killed Ismail Haniyeh while they were negotiating with him mm-hmm. in Qatar.
Yeah.
And they accepted to talk, it seems, in the what the foreign minister of Lebanon was talking about, that they have agreed on have some sort of ceasefire. They have killed Nasrallah. And at the end of the day, Matt Miller is talking about, we are trying to do our best to put some sort of political settlement to find a ceasefire, but they're not agreeing on anything. It's unbelievable the way that he's trying to draw the picture and everybody knows he's lying.
Yeah. I mean, that's you've seen a pattern here, right? People that are involved with negotiations with Israel get killed. They use those negotiations as a pretext to set them up, to understand where they're going, what they're going to do, so they can target them. And the United States has been a collaborator with Israel in that regard. You know, the rest of the world is waking up to this. You know, they're looking at you going, they can't believe it, that a state could be so cynical, so diabolical. But that's what Israel is proving to be. You know, I know that in my own case, my views and attitude towards Israel turned 180 degrees. They are, you know, I don't buy their lies anymore. It's the easiest way to put it.
Is Netanyahu capable of convincing Putin not to support Syria or even Iran?
Well, no, the short answer. But for Putin, I think, what is it, roughly... almost 20% of Israel's population, current population, are Russian citizens. So there are Russian Jews who left Russia and went to Israel. Now, what's interesting, and a lot of them are some very wealthy oligarchs, as well as some notorious criminals that have found safe haven in Israel, but they're Jewish, so you know they get a pass. Putin reportedly the other day, Netanyahu tried to call Putin to talk, and Putin wouldn't take the call. I think he was sending the Israelis a clear message. Israel has been condemned in the strongest terms possible, in terms of diplomatic language, at the UN Security Council by Ambassador Nebenzia. And, I think Russia's come to the conclusion that it's going to continue to help Syria, continue to help Iran, and expand, actually, its military cooperation with Iran.
Yeah. Larry, here is Ben Wallace talking about how the West can win the war in Ukraine against Russia. And he's suggesting that we have to follow the same path that Netanyahu, the same attitude that Netanyahu is experiencing, is taking in the Middle East. And he's suggesting that we have to attack Russia. The way that he's talking about, he's suggesting to send more weapons to Ukraine, support them. But at the end of the day, when you look at the strategy on the part of Netanyahu and his administration, you find two main objectives. One of them is killing civilians. The other one is just assassinating the head of Hamas, the head of Hezbollah. If we think that way, he's suggesting that the Ukrainians should do the same. And even NATO or whoever supports Ukraine should do the same in Ukraine. That would be huge. That would be unbelievable if he's trying to suggest that.
Yeah, I'm at a loss of words in trying to describe what a cretin, a moron, an imbecile Ben Wallace is. That what he is not even thinking through second, third level consequences of these kinds of actions. He goes with the assumption that, boy, yeah, like if we kill Putin, get rid of Putin, then we'll be okay. Really? You know, consider the possibility that somebody actually who is not like Vladimir Putin, who's not patient, who's not deliberative, who is emotional, and who is ready to blow up the West, could replace Putin. Then what happens, Ben Wallace? Because the British military certainly doesn't have any clout. I mean, Britain, the United Kingdom, is just a goddamn joke. It's they dress up and play military. They have no actual real military capability that could be deployed and last more than a week. And yet they're out there with this kind of chest thumping and trying to incite greater violence. Russia has nuclear weapons and a lot of them. And Russia has an air defense system that actually works, unlike anything that's in Great Britain or the United States. And Russia has a better trained army that's combat experienced, unlike the United States, unlike Great Britain. So this madman wants to incite and put to, you know, get out there and see how many more Russians they can kill. Does he not know history? The Russian people, it's in their culture. They've dealt with repeated invasions through centuries, and for the most part have fought them off successfully or prevailed ultimately. And with over, you know, the last 225 years, with Napoleon's failed venture to destroy Russia and then Hitler's failed venture, Russia keeps coming up on top. But they push, you know, the mythology is pushed that, you know, Russia is this aggressive imperial power. When Russia, you know, barely has any, really doesn't have any significant military bases outside of Europe and Asia along its border. Most of its military bases in other countries are just right on its border. They're not set up in South America and Central America like the United States or in Africa, as the United States has been, or, you know, and throughout Asia, you know. So Wallace is, he's a reason actually why this war is being fought as it is, because the demilitarization of Ukraine also means demilitarize NATO, destroy NATO. And in my view, NATO needs to be dismantled because it's become a toxic entity.
Larry, what's going on in Ugledar? Right now it's in the hand of Russians. And what does it mean for the battlefield?
Well, that Ugledar is just, again, it's not a key battle from the standpoint that the takeover of that town is going to unhinge the entire defensive line that the Ukrainians have in place. But it is representative of the kind of campaign that the Russians are currently conducting, where they're moving at a very rapid pace all along that, you know, 900 mile front or 1200 kilometer front. They are pushing back Ukrainian forces, and the Ukrainians don't have the artillery, they don't have the trained manpower to resist. So this is, you know, we're at the start of the Rasputitsa, the muddy season, and within, you know, another month, we're going to be talking the onset of winter conditions. And Ukraine is going to have a very, very difficult time of sustaining itself, if they're able to. I question, actually, that they'll be able to do so. So we could, you know, we could see a pretty rapid conclusion to this conflict simply because Ukraine's going to run out of gas.
Larry, in your opinion, right now, in the eyes of Europeans, what's going on? Because recently we've learned that Macron was talking about the first priority of the United States is the United States. The second would be China. And here is what he said.
We have to be lucid on our situation. Europe is no more the top priority of the US. The US top priority is US, which is normal and fair. The second top priority is China. And for the rest, it depends on the moment. They are a super loyal and reliable partner on Ukraine. Will it last? I don't know. But let's be clear, at the same time, in Afghanistan, we didn't have the call before. And in the AUKUS deal in Australia, I didn't have the call before. But it's not a reproach. I try to be lucid. The EU is not the priority of the US. And this is why part of the wake-up call period of time we are living, and part of what we have to completely reshape, is our defense and security strategy. We are part of NATO, no discussion. We are a strong ally of the US, no discussion. But we have to de-risk our model from the US agenda.
Yeah. And on the other hand, we've learned that the foreign minister of France, if I'm not mistaken, he said that our main threat or main enemy, not enemy, the threat is coming from Russia. Because how you can say that? What is Russia today that they're so concerned of Russia?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, when I say I don't know, there is nothing objective. No, there's no objective action or fact you can point to that would say, oh my God, this is where Russia is threatening France. It really goes back to the arrogance and the colonial mentality of the French and the British. You know, for years they were in great competition to see who could control how much of the world. I mean, the French controlled Indochina, and the French controlled many countries in Africa, and the Brits, and, you know, they were dominating the world. They were exploiting other countries, robbing and stealing from them. And they, I think what they see is, you know, they see that Russia is a major obstacle to them being able to do that anymore. In fact, Russia's actually helping the Africans kick the French out of Africa, you know, in the central part of Africa. So, you know, France is just pissed off that they're no longer relevant, because they're not. They're an irrelevancy. They're in the decline of their, you know, whatever empire they once had. It's fallen apart, and their country is divided internally as well. And so what you're seeing throughout Europe right now is the emergence of greater division. They're not all pulling together. They're not all united. It's just the opposite. And it's going to be more like every man for himself. You know, you try to say everybody's drowning. Everyone is going to see who gets into the lifeboat first.
Yeah. This is an article in The Hill, and it says that why do Russians appear so satisfied despite the war in Ukraine? And what would be your answer, Larry, to this question? Because so far, when you look at the battlefield, the question is why not? And
well, why do the Russians appear satisfied? Because their government works. Their economy is strong. People have jobs. The streets are safe. The children are well educated. So, you know, the people look around and realize they've got a good life. And they're not sitting around lusting after other countries about, oh, we need to go capture this country or that country because they've got resources that we need. Russia's got such a big country, needs people to, you know, to mine and exploit the resources they have there. So that's why Russia's satisfied, because it's not like a shithole that much of the West has become.
Yeah. Here is Lindsey Graham talking, addressing what's going on in your state, Florida, in North Carolina, and with considering the hurricane, Larry.
You can thank Donald Trump and Elon Musk for that.
You know, I've been going all over South Carolina like most people. I hadn't slept much. But look what's going on in Israel. Our friends in Israel are surrounded by people that want to kill them, destroy them, a second Holocaust in the making. And Biden says, be proportional. What is the proportional response to people who want to kill you and your family? Gosh. They're running out of ammunition in Israel. We have to help our friends to keep the war over there from coming here.
Yeah, in order to address what's going on there, he's going to talk about Israel.
Yeah, well, all you have to do is just sit down and count the numbers. How many Israelis have been killed? How many have been killed? So Israel said that on October 7th, 1,139 Israelis were killed by Hamas. But that's a lie. Maybe as much as 50% of those Israelis were killed by Israel itself. And as it carried out its military operations to stop people from being taken hostage and carried back into Gaza. Since then, you've had Israeli soldiers killed, but despite all the rocket fire from Hezbollah, it hasn't been causing massive civilian casualties at all. The only one doing the killing of civilians is Israel. They're the major culprit. Women and children every single day. And they justify it because, oh, we're fighting terrorism because they're trying to kill us. It's just an excuse. It's like they're almost like this two Jewish boys that killed their parents and then pleaded for mercy because they were orphans. You know.
Larry, there are two concepts. Yesterday, I talked with Michael Hudson together with Richard Wolff. What Michael Hudson was suggesting that what's going on in the Middle East is because of the United States. United States is running the show. United States in charge of what's going on in the Middle East. Or we can say that United States is running Israel. And the other, I talked earlier yesterday morning, I talked with Gilbert Doctorow. He was suggesting the same thing, that
yeah, I think that's
policy in the Middle East.
Nonsense. Yeah. Nonsense.
And
Dr. Rowe is absolutely wrong. You know, and with all due respect to Michael Hudson and Wolf, the money that's flowing from AIPAC into congressional coffers, the punishments that is meted out against members of Congress that don't go along, don't vote for this. We've had time after time right now where Biden has tried to chastise Israel, tried to direct Israel in some other direction. And Netanyahu just basically says, hey, Biden, fuck off. Okay? This is, you know, the notion that the U.S. has a strategy, good God, that assumes that there's somebody who's thinking and has a plan. This is not planned. This is all reaction. We don't plan. Nobody had a damn plan when we went into Iraq in 2003. They were making it up as they went along. I mean, I know that for a fact. I was friends with Jerry Bremer, L. Paul Bremer, who got designated to be the Grand Poobah of Iraq. Jerry didn't have a clue. He had no experience in that area. He was just following orders from the Pentagon. So this notion that this is some grand strategy, you know, it's nonsense. Absolute nonsense. But hey, Dr. Rose, welcome to indulge whatever fantasy he wants. But the way this power relationship goes, it is you either support Israel or you're an anti-Semite and you're going to be shunned from society. You're going to be economically destroyed. You'll be politically destroyed. So, you know, that's not a U.S. strategy by any stretch. That's Netanyahu. That's this Zionist group of zealots.
Yeah. Just to wrap it up, to wrap up this session, Larry, I'm going to play a clip that Julian Assange is talking about CIA. I want your reaction on this.
CIA Director Pompeo launched a campaign of retribution. It is now a matter of public record that under Pompeo's explicit direction, the CIA drew up plans to kidnap and to assassinate me within the Ecuadorian embassy in London and authorized going after my European colleagues, subjecting us to theft, hacking attacks, and the planting of false information. My wife and my infant son were also targeted. A CIA asset was permanently assigned to track my wife, and instructions were given to obtain DNA from my six-month-old son's nappy. This is the testimony of more than 30 current and former US intelligence officials speaking to the US press, which has been additionally corroborated by records seized in a prosecution brought against some of the CIA agents involved. The CIA's targeting of myself, my family, and my associates through aggressive extrajudicial and extraterritorial means provides a rare insight into how powerful intelligence organizations engage in transnational repression. Such repressions are not unique. What is unique is that we know so much about this one due to numerous whistleblowers and to judicial investigations in Spain.
Yeah. And how did you find it, Larry?
I know he's absolutely right. You know, and this just goes again to illustrate that U.S. foreign policy is almost punitive. That it's not about bringing peace, prosperity to the world. It's about making sure that we can punish anybody that gets in our way that doesn't do what we want them to do. You know, and Julian Assange, he committed the crime, as he said, of journalism, of reporting things that exposed the U.S. lies, particularly about the war in Iraq, And he had to be destroyed, shut down because of it. So it is, again, it shows you how out of control the U.S. government has become. And, you know, this is, there's almost an air of desperation about it. We're no longer honest with ourselves about what's really happening overseas. So we, you know, create these mythologies and then embrace them. And I think it's dangerous.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us today. Great pleasure as always.
I will see you sometime on Monday, I guess.
Right? Yeah, that's right.
Let's hope we have a peaceful weekend, but you know, the way things are, we never know.
Yeah, that's all. See you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Bye.